answer. Every Arizona homeowner's best friend.
Come on in, Arizona. It's 10 o'clock hour, the third hour of Rosie on the House, the open home hour, open to you, the Arizona homeowner, whatever you want to talk about, your home, castle, or cabin. 1-888-767-4348. 1-888-ROSIE for you. If you'd like to join the conversation, Jess is behind the glass. She'll get your name, the zip code of the residential you're calling about, and ensure that there's a good connection because it's not great here. Horrible listening experience, so we'll ensure that we've got a good quality phone connection and get you into the program. Or again, text questions to 411-923 if you're out and about. And not like the old days where people had phones with cords that were attached to a receiver on the desk and they'd sit in their lazy boy for 45 minutes to an hour waiting to get on the line. If you can't pick up the phone like within three rings, if you're already talking to somebody, getting their information, and another call's ringing, it's like if you can't get to that within three rings, peace out, they're gone. And then you can always expect to see a text message show up there shortly afterwards. It's changed definitely over the years on how we communicate with the listeners, but we're still here since 1988. This program has been on the air on Saturday morning. We've got Bruce Stumble from Rosie Wright Remodeling joining us in studio as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having me again.
And I'm glad you were in because I got a question this week about fire sprinklers. This Joel in Scottsdale is doing an addition to his house, and the city is requiring that he add fire sprinklers.
Yep. Yeah, that's so there's a – I won't get into all the boring details because I'm sure Joel is very – familiar now, but basically there's a calculation based on square footage of the addition value of the house. This isn't actually based on the value of the house, but and once you cross a certain threshold, you have to add fire sprinklers. So it's just something that they require. It is a safety thing, obviously. It can be a little bit of a bummer for existing homeowners to have to retrofit a existing house with that, but it's something that Scottsdale does require.
Now, have you ever run into a situation where that has put somebody out of budget from doing their remodeling project because the additional expense that they were unexpecting?
We have occasionally had it, yeah, because it's, as you can imagine, it's not cheap to retrofit a house with fire sprinklers because there's kind of a domino effect. You got to do the fire sprinklers, and you usually have to do a larger main water line, and usually the water meter that's the city's isn't big enough, so now you got to pay to get that upgraded too, and you know there's just this domino effect. So every once in a while, yeah, we've had people that haven't been able to do it, and oftentimes, unfortunately for them, while still good that they're getting to do something, they just have to scale back somewhere else, so they might not get something in the house that they really wanted. So.
And when you're talking about the water line, because we're not using the water that's supplying our faucets and our water heater, it's a different line designated for the fire sprinklers?
Kind of. So coming off the meter, it's the same. Uh-huh. But where it comes up to your house, it splits off from there. So you have, like, the vast majority of our houses, you go on the outside of the house, you'll find where the water comes into your house and your main shutoff valve's out there, which always, you know, people from the East Coast and the Midwest are always shocked, but, you know, doesn't get cold enough down here. So it comes up, taps into the house, and then it'll come up a little further, and that's your next one that's actually your, you know, potable water supply. But it's feeding the same water. Commercial is a little bit different, but in a residence. And then there's a number of requirements, which is why you need to use, you know, licensed people for such things. You won't be able to not, because the fire marshal does an inspection. And
but it's completely piped separately. It's after the meter, it breaks off. So you've got your landscape, your water supply for your water using features, and then the fire sprinkler.
Yeah, so from the meter underground to the edge of their house, it's the same pipe. Uh-huh. But and then from there, yes,
broken
where it comes
it
up out
the
of the ground, typically it's going to tap off for fire sprinkler, tap off for irrigation, tap off for main water supply.
So it's not like if you've got PEX running through the attic, you'd be like, oh, just add some sprinkler heads,
no,
tee it off the PEX and put it in the house. It's a completely separate infrastructure.
It is. Yeah, it's all separate, and there's a specific type of PVC piping. It's orange that gets used for that in residential applications. I'm not a commercial expert, and I'm not necessarily a fire sprinkler expert, but we deal with it pretty regularly. So, and we have experts that do it for us. So,
is that only Scottsdale, or are there other cities? You know, because each municipality has the option mm-hmm. on what building code mm-hmm. and the extent of the building code that they're going to enforce. Yeah.
So, Fountain Hills requires it. I don't remember the exact year. I believe they were a little bit after Scottsdale. Phoenix requires it over a certain square footage. You have to be building a pretty large house. And I have, as to this point, we have never done a remodel where fire sprinklers ended up being required in Phoenix. We've most certainly done it in Scottsdale.
So you got to have a pretty big McMansion in
it's
Phoenix.
It's pretty, I don't remember the exact square footage, but it's bigger than your typical house for sure. So. And then there's a couple others around, you know, those are the cities that I'm the most familiar with, because that's where we do most of our work. But, I believe some cities out in the West Valley and some of the newer construction are requiring it, but, don't quote me on that because I'm most certainly not an expert out in the West Valley.
I would think you'd get some break on your insurance on that as well.
That is what I am told. My house is, you know, late 1970s ranch in Phoenix, so I don't have fire sprinklers, so I don't know. But we have had clients say that they've let their insurance agent know after they had to add it and that it did bring down the cost, which is always a little – I mean, I get that the structure doesn't burn down. And fire sprinklers are not to save your house. That's the thing. They're to save your life. That's what I tell people.
Oh, I never thought about that.
The amount of water that's going to get pumped into your house – when there's a fire, I mean, we've all seen what happens to houses when firefighters have to go in. It's not all that different. Now, maybe just one head pops in a room and it's just a water damage in a certain area. But if you have a big fire in your house and all those sprinklers are going off, there's still a lot of damage. But it's hopefully saving your life. So,
and whatever the dollar you're saving off of insurance versus the cost to install it, you're probably at like a 50-year payoff time.
There's a potential, yeah. I don't know the insurance side of that, so I've never sat down and tried to crunch those numbers. I don't make it a selling point. It just it's something that we have do or don't have to do. And if you do have to do it, then look, you have the peace of mind that, you know, you have an extra layer of safety in case there is a house fire. So,
and I would imagine at some point, all new construction is going to be required. I mean, it just seems like once one municipality or building code is introduced, it's only a matter of time before it becomes a standard on the universal and it's applied.
Fire sprinklers have been slower for whatever reason, but like examples with electrical. The newest IRC, which is the International Residential Code, and NEC, National Electric Code, that have come out that some of the cities are adopting, have all sorts of new requirements. Some kind of cool, some that a lot of people, some of our clients so far have been unhappy that we've had to do. But because the unfortunate byproduct of a lot of that is it's just continues to drive construction prices up. So that is I don't know if it's unintended or not, but it's a consequence of a lot of those new regulations that it is driving the square footage price of construction up sometimes considerably, you know, every time that update comes out. So,
and I wouldn't have a problem with the cost of construction going up if it meant the building's going to last 100 years, 200 years, 300 years. It's going to have a payout. Adding fire sprinklers isn't going to extend the life of your home.
No, some of that... Some of the stuff is safety, which, like I said, I understand. You know, when we go into a house and remodel, the minute you pull a permit now, you have to update the house to current fire protection standards. There's some things that you can do. So, like in a flat roof house, we don't have to tear apart the whole house just to add wired smoke detectors. There are some approved wireless ones, but they have to be interconnected and they have to have a 10-year lithium battery and et cetera, et cetera. But, some of the stuff now is like switches. In new construction, and I'm trying to remember this off the top of my head. I don't have my code checkbook in front of me, but you won't be able to have a normal light switch in your bedroom anymore. You're going to have either a dimmer or an occupancy sensor.
So when you walk in, it would automatically turn on?
And then turn off after a little while for energy savings. And you, they're restricting more and more the type of light fixture, the wattage it can use, all that sort of stuff, which, you know, sounds nice, but a occupancy sensor switch is about $50 and a regular switch is about $7. So,
and is it required in the entire house or just the
In new construction, it'll be the entire, and I don't have the book in front of me, and this is still relatively new, so this is not gospel here, but it's the bedrooms, the like living room, family room, places like that. I believe the areas that they've exempted from it so far are bathrooms and hallways that you could have like on just a normal switch so that it would just stay on. But a lot of those other ones are going to be required to have something for energy efficiency. So, and there's quite a few other things that go along with it. And what a lot of people don't realize in a remodel, when we pull that permit, a lot of the cities require you, at least in that remodel area, that you have to do it to new construction standards. And depending on, and this is another one of those, I know guys that from companies in other parts of the country that, you know, each one of our cities can be different on which of the codes that they've adopted yet. Uh-huh. So some of them are still using 2018, whereas like Scottsdale just went to, I think that's 2021 is the one that, so from city to city, your requirements on the submittal and the construction can be different, which is a challenge, you know, but it's part of our job to keep up with all that.
Join the conversation about your home, castle, or cabin, 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you, or text 411-923. There's also email, like Mark here, at info@rosieonthehouse.com. This is a fun one. Bonjour! Lived in the valley from the 70s to 2001 and was gone to Idaho for 20 years. Back in Arizona, and I remember from my old days, Rosie was talking about exterior paint on the house, but I don't remember the specifics as it relates to Arizona. Currently, I have a house with two types of plaster slash stucco coating on it that needs to be repainted. House was originally built in the 40s with adobe, 1-inch thick plaster, and an addition was built in the 60s with concrete block and plaster stucco coating. And wants to talk about how to properly redo the painting of your home. And, you know, this is one of those, you know, you can do it yourself. Last hour, we had Durafoam roofing and talking flat roofs. You know, foam roofing isn't anything you could ever do yourself. You're going to spend $250,000 on the equipment, and and then you got to have the truck to move it and the product. I mean, you're never going to do that as a do-it-yourself job unless you're the applicator and your boss lets you rent the truck home for the weekend. You pay for the material. But a painting job you could do yourself. If it's on a block home, especially, you know, it sounds like an exception where it was probably 8816 CMUs that they then plastered and painted over the top.
Could be.
Because you wouldn't put a decorative red brick or a slump block or a ranch style masonry and then paint plaster over that. But that is one thing that drives me nuts when I see a great old block home where the block is the decorative finish and somebody's painted it. I'm like, you've taken a forever material and now created a ongoing maintenance expense because the paint's not going to last forever. So to keep it looking good, you've got to repaint it every, you know, 10 or so years, where if you just left it the decorative block finish, you've got a forever, you know, if you wanted to, of the redness or the color in the slump might fade over time and you could do some sealers on it that would be, you know, kind of bring back a deeper color and do that every now and then, but it's not required. Well, then you paint it, you've got to redo it. So paint is the prep and everything.
Yeah, preparing it, making sure you have a clean surface. You know, I'm I don't ever like to assume, but I'm guessing he knows all that. But, you know, prep work, make sure all the loose paint's off, that sort of thing. And then for almost every exterior wall in Arizona, you know, we recommend that you use 100% acrylic paint. There's all sorts of stuff out there. Most of it's noise marketing. 100% acrylic is the way to go. It allows things to breathe. Like, that's the problem with like a latex or something like that, that we've really gone away from, other than there's some indoor application where that's good. But, on stucco, we always recommend 100% acrylic. I personally, getting into sheens is a little less important. I personally, especially what it sounds like, what I'm envisioning what his home looks like, I would go with a flatter paint. I think it looks better, but that's a personal choice. I drive by some houses sometimes and they use like a semi-gloss on the exterior and it's shiny. And I'm just like, what are you doing?
Well, I think the higher sheens, don't they cost more?
They can.
And it's going to get dulled out by the UV eventually. So
once again, personal preference, but especially for something that's got a stucco like there, flat paint is typically the way to go. Now, if he actually has adobe with plaster over it, which is, you know, they are around, we've worked on some. If that's the case and any of it's damaged, I would strongly suggest you find somebody who works on adobe surfaces to repair it. That's very specialized. I wouldn't just let anybody work on that. Adobe houses are really cool, but you need to find people who know how to do the repairs. So,
yeah, very limited number of adobe homes in Arizona currently, and very limited number of tradesmen that know what to do with that. Now, when you're applying the paint, this is where it becomes not a do-it-yourself, but a two-person job, mm-hmm. because if you're going to use a sprayer, which most people are, spray up, down, sideways, both ways, but it's critical to have somebody behind you with a roller
rolling it back on,
because it doesn't matter how good you are with the paint wand and the application to get a smooth, consistent, and complete coat.
Yep.
Got a back roll.
Yeah, when you're spraying, especially if you have all exterior surfaces you should, but especially with stucco and the little bit heavier texture ones, a lot of times what people call like a Spanish lace or something, which you don't see as much on new homes anymore, but you see a lot on a little bit older homes. You are not getting paint in all those cracks and crevices with a sprayer. You've got to have somebody coming behind back roll on that.
All right, well, Wayne's online, wants to talk about a contractor he's working with, and Steve wants to talk about subterranean walls. But of all the things we can do here at Rosie on the House, we can't stop the clock. Time for bottom of the hour news break. But when we get back, we'll get to the calls and whatever you'd like to talk about at 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. No real scientific pattern here to callers. First on the line, first on the air. Steve, subterranean walls. How can we help you?
Yeah, I was just listening to you talk about the foam roofing, and it just it's second to none anywhere in the valley here. I used to be an applicator here, and I just believe it is like the best thing you could put on the roof here in Arizona. However, there's multiple uses for the foam. I did walls to waterproof the walls, subterranean walls. I'm wondering if they're still doing anything like that. Is it still being foamed, or is it something that there's new? Or I'm just curious, is there other applications that you know about that foam is good for?
Well, when we were talking to Tim during the break, and he was just talking about the different types of foam applications, because I asked him the same thing, because You know, in a new construction, you see it a lot in cathedral style.
Yep. For the insulation
in the attic.
Yep.
You see it in the walls a lot. I've got a friend building a house in Cave, Queen Creek, and he said his foam applicator said something really funny because he was – it's a steel building, so it's not common in Arizona. So he's having a hard time with the building inspectors and what is
Oh, I remember you telling me about him, yeah.
And then, you know, the trade contractors, you know, well, you know, they're not used to it. So it's been a learning process, but he said it's – one area of the roof where they were trying to get the two areas to meet, the foam contractor just said, do your best, we'll foam the rest. You know, had a lot of mistakes with foam.
Yeah, foam, I think the most common other applications in it, there are some very specific requirements with insulation, but it's the same process pretty much, so... Attic, what we call cathedral style insulation, wall insulation now. I have not seen it be used on like underground waterproofing, like for a basement or something like that. That is not something that would be approved. If it was, it's not anymore to my knowledge that we you use there's a number of ways to do it, but some of the best ways is you put a mastic on the block with a number of other things. That's actually gotten pretty I won't say high tech, but more parts to it than what they used to do of just slapping some tar based stuff on the block and calling it good. There's a number of things that are systems that are applied now.
And you don't see a lot of basements in Arizona.
Not very many. They're around.
Most of your quote subterranean walls. Hillside lots,
yes,
where they have a bigger infrastructure that they have to do on the uphill side of it. And what I have seen and the best practice is it's a, you know, whatever product they put on the outside, then they'll go back and they'll put soundboard against it. So when they backfill, the dirt doesn't penetrate the waterproofing agent.
Yeah. And there's actually, there's meshes now that they use that keep it off of that. And then there's layers of, and I may not be getting all of this technically correct because, like you said, we don't do a lot of basements, but we have people that do. But then you use a specific type of fill back there and all that. So
and the reason we don't have a lot of basements isn't because of the hard digging. Which we do have, like, some caliche that's hard to get through. But really, we don't have a frost line, so you don't need to dig more than 6 inches to meet building code.
So
it's not an expense most people incur. Although, if I was building my own home and had an endless budget, I would absolutely sink a basement underneath 1,000%. The entire home because the dirt, earth is going to insulate that living space better
it's
than
cooler down
anything
there.
Up top is going to do.
Yep.
The third segment where we cover our weekly to-do when we remember to do it. Sometimes we can blow right through them. I think we're going to hit 3 in a row here this week.
This month.
Yeah. And you can find these in your Rosie on the House Homeowner Handbook. We're talking Rid the Critters today. We've got nice wet winter behind us, brought a lot of weeds, brought a lot of moisture. Both of those things bring the bugs.
And, you know, there are no, if you're new to Arizona, this may surprise you. There's no shortage of critters in Arizona. Arizona Game and Fish Department manages over 800 species just in Arizona. Now, that doesn't count termites, ants,
bugs,
locusts.
They're not on the game and fish priority list.
But there's no shortage of wildlife and critters in Arizona. You know, Arizona has more species of rattlesnakes than any other state in the country. There are 20 different rattlesnakes. Arizona has 14 of them. You don't like snakes? Alaska has 0.
Really?
Alaska has 0 rattlesnakes.
Well, rattlesnakes, but there's got to be some kind of snake that lives in the mountains.
I don't know. You know, we have 5 different types of ground squirrels. So the first thing I'd like to tell people in managing their critters, because depending on where you are, you're probably dealing with different critters in Bouse or Wickiup or Aravaica or Sholo. or Maricopa County or Pima County. So know this, that if it's game that's invading your landscaping, your garden area, Arizona Fish and Game is a good resource to contact, and they'll help you manage away the opportunities that discourage the walk-ins from the deer, the elk, antelope, javelina, bear.
Their website has a lot of good.
They do. Yeah. They have a ton.
For the majority of our listening audience, you're going to be facing coyotes first and then javelina second.
Yeah, lots of – and I'll tell you what, my Nextdoor app is alive with photos of bobcats.
You got them moving in?
I mean, to tell you, they're everywhere. So wildlife is one area of managing and ridding critters. And then you've got the other real nuisance critters, scorpions, poison spiders, mosquitoes, wasps, and termites. What's the first thing we tell people is scorpions?
Well, it's how clean is your property?
Get rid of their food. And what's their
wood piles.
What's their number one food?
Crickets.
Crickets.
That love to live in wood piles.
leaf litter. Firewood piles, anywhere a cricket likes to live, a family of scorpions lives there too. So the number one preventative for scorpions is don't feed them.
I have to watch a scorpion. They don't strike me as something fast enough to get a cricket that can hop. But they say it's one of their number one food source. I'd like to see how they capture them.
Okay. Well, we'll have to
creep up at night and use their stinger while sleeping.
That's a good question. So let's not create a condition. We talked about conditions conducive for termites. Let's not create conditions conducive for scorpions by making sure our leaf litter's picked up, no wood debris laying down. Conditions conducive for termites? How about the condensate drain on your air conditioner? How close is it draining to the foundation of your house? You know, that's generating, if it's one air conditioner in the middle of the summer, in the middle of monsoon season, you're dumping 7 gallons of water at a constant drip 24 hours a day. It's no time at all, a week, 10 days, 2 weeks. You've got an entire puddle of water the size of a bedroom sitting there in the soil beside your foundation. All of that moisture is conditions conducive to termite infestation. So let's take that condensate drain and get it out away from the foundation, at least 2 or 3 feet.
And like Rosie said, it's not something you'd have to keep all year long, so you don't have to do any kind of glue fitting. Just get a coupling and a longer pipe and get it a couple more feet away when the air conditioning is not running, and when the humidity from the rains move on, you know, it's not going to be, you could go another 6, 7, 8 months without having any condensation flow out.
And then you've got people always want to ask about screening. You know, can I screen the bottom of my door sweeps? Can I screen the plumbing vents? Yeah, you can, but you'd be surprised how small a mesh it takes to be completely effective. What these critters can squeeze through is pretty incredible. One of the things we like in and about around horse property is we like just big bags of food grade DE sprinkled around the perimeter in the areas where the bugs are most likely to be producing, habitating, or moving through. And we have found that to be a regular schedule of food-grade DE sprinkled lightly in the right areas and the right applications seem to work better for us in eliminating the critters getting in the house.
Yeah, and when you're talking about using screens on certain areas, one area that you don't want to do any kind of thing to is at the bottom of your stucco. If it's a wood-framed home, which most of them are, there's a metal strip that's the bottom of the stucco before you see the concrete stem wall. Ever so often, and I don't have the measurements off the top of my head, but it's like every 18, 16 inches, there's a 2 or 3 inch cut in that. And a lot of, I haven't seen this in a while, but you know, a lot of extermination companies, they would sell you that. It's like, look, here's where everything's getting into your home. You need us to come seal you up. And they've got cameras on a stick or mirrors on a stick that they send down. They're like, see all these slots? We've got to seal all those. And it was just one way to upcharge. Well, that is there so moisture can wick out because water, your stucco's not waterproof. Your paint's not waterproof. They're shedding agents. But moisture and heavy rains and saturation, water can condense in behind your stucco, and that's designed to drip down the lathing paper that's put to the outside of your sheathing and weep out the bottom. You do not want to have those sealed up. And no, I've never seen any indication that those were used for any kind of significant bug infestation. Have you? So, yeah, because if the home is properly designed, if they get in there, they're not going to find any food. And even though in the rain season there's moisture, it's nothing that's going to be a habitat for them. So keep those free and clear. And there are a number of great pest control companies that do regular maintenance. They'll come out, treat, apply, ask you what you're seeing, if you're seeing any this, that time of the year, change there. Product applications to help keep, you know, your home bug free. And there is, I've seen a lot more mosquitoes in the last couple years, and I don't know what that's from, but even specialty companies that do mosquito abatement, which isn't anything I've ever used to growing up and seeing in Arizona. I mean, you go visit family in Louisiana, and that's just part of the state services is coming through and fogging. So rid the critters, that's our weekly to-do, and it's all focused on preventative maintenance, eliminating the condition-conducive environment for them to thrive on your home or property. Wayne called in with an issue out on a contractor. It's not somebody that is part of the Rosie on the House Certified Partner Referral Network, so we won't take it on air, but basically what happened, got the quote, got a few quotes, went with the higher priced one, project's done, contractor hands him the final bill, it's $3,000 over what he was estimated, and when asked why, he said he had to do extra prep work before he could start setting the tile. And obviously, you know, a little unexpected. A little shock. Hang on, I got to turn your mic on.
There we go. I'm good. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there can be a lot of additional prep work that has to go into properly doing a floor. The unfortunate thing is sometimes what should have happened, like, if it was a project we were involved in, you'd walk it with the client, show them what's going on, explain what needs to be fixed, and give them the additional cost right then and there. Now, you know, estimates are estimates. So that's a warning. They can't see what's underneath it. However, it sounds like in this situation that flooring contractor really should have walked it with the client after the demolition was done to explain what was going on and what the additional cost was going to be to prep it for the new tile.
And so they did do a pre-walk before that, and he never mentioned anything about the extra expense. Yeah. So that's one thing that, you know, kind of chaps him even a little bit further.
No, I get it. It's we hear it a lot. Unfortunately, it's something that, you know, our policy with our projects is to get something that was a surprise in front of the client as soon as possible, get them the options, if there are any, if there's multiple, and then what the additional cost for that is, and just get it over with. You know, it doesn't help to wait, because and then you have people like, you know, Wayne upset at the end. So,
and Wayne's already paid him, so there's very little that he can do, but mm-hmm. You had made a great point that showing proof.
Yeah.
Like, how many extra hours was it? Yeah. How much extra material was it?
Yeah,
me some evidence that you really did this mm-hmm. extra work and you're not just fleecing me for $3,000.
Yeah, what he said that overage was, you know, depending on how many square feet it is and all that sort of stuff, it absolutely could be that much of an overage for prep work. But it's also, if he has a normal size house, that's a significant extra for floor prep. So there should be, it shouldn't be hard to explain slash prove what the extra work does. I mean, that's either a pretty decent amount of self-leveling concrete or quite a bit of grinding that had to happen. Or I mean, that's hours and hours and hours of grinding for a charge like that. Self-leveling concrete a bag does add up real quick. So, we've certainly had, we've had houses where we've had to use 36 bags in, a room and a half. But it should be easy for that floor person to explain slash show what all went into that. So,
and he also asked, is this something that is worth filing a report with the Register of Contractors? Well, no. They don't do anything that revolves around invoicing or pricing. No. Their regulatory and enforcement comes to do with work done to code. So you can even have workmanship done poorly, but if it was up to code, there's still nothing the registrar will then enforce. Yeah. So as long as it's to code, that's really what the Register of Contractors enforcing. Yeah. Come back and make the contractor do the work to code.
Yeah. Yeah, there's only so much they can do, So
at that point, you're into a small claims process, which unfortunately it's probably going to cost you more than $3,000 in time, money, and frustration to go through that. And there's no guarantee that
you'll win it. So,
right.
Because depending on the way their contract's written and all that, there's probably an exclusion in there that says something to do with that. So now nobody reads the fine print. I mean, we all click on little boxes every day where we ignore all the fine print, but it's probably in there and it probably protect them. And unfortunately, this is just a situation of poor communication, which the vast majority of complaints that I hear about people working in a house where people are mad about something at the end, it almost always comes down to bad communication.
Yeah, definitely. And in an application where if this had been one of our contractors, we would have done what you said, go out and show us the justification for this. Why wasn't there a communication? And I don't know the extent of it, but because there was no communication before and that added amount was agreed upon and invoiced, there is going to be a negotiation there of dollar amount. As being in business as a contractor, unfortunately, there are jobs that you have a loss on. It's not a profitable job, and you have to go out of savings to make up for it. But when it's your fault, it's your fault. It needs to be honored. And unfortunately, that's one of why it's so hard to stay in business as a contractor. We were talking about statistics with somebody. It's, within the first 5 years, 90% are out of business. Yep. And then after that, the 10% that make it, the percent that make it another 5 years is like another only 20% of the 90% will make it past that 10-year mark.
It's not an easy business.
No, sir. But I wish I had better news for you. Bob, hang tight. He's got a painting question. We'll finish talking, taking your call off the air.